one of the designated committee members needs to assume the chairmanship. And so Mary has graciously offered to do that. We're very excited to be working with her. So let me just tell you a little bit about Mary. She is currently the IP coordinator at Kaiser Westside. She started there in May 2013. And so she's responsible for NHSN reporting, surveillance, overseas isolation practices, placing evidence-based research into policy, doing a lot of leadership and hand hygiene, IP education. So there's somebody who's very experienced at the helm here. And prior to that, she was at Providence St. Vincent's for 7 years, and then Legacy prior to that. And prior to that, at Tigard Rehab, and then has been a patient care coordinator for community health, and a staff nurse in various ICUs. So we are, that wasn't the takeaway, but she's experienced across all settings, which I think is gonna be an ongoing theme for this committee, is really figuring out what we can do in terms of surveillance and prevention across various settings. So with that, I will turn it over to Mary to take us through the agenda.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Kate. So we'll call the meeting to order. I guess we have taken our attendance. Anybody else on the phone that has not announced themselves?
This is KJ Peruna at Orange State OHSU.
Okay. So has everybody had a moment to review the minutes from both June and September?
Yes.
Okay. So does anybody have any comments or changes they'd like to make in the minutes? If not, do we have a move to approve?
So moved.
Okay, the minutes will be approved as written.
Excellent. So, and then I guess that's for September. We have to do two meeting minutes because we didn't have a quorum last time. So
June and September.
June and September.
Okay.
Are they approved?
I move that both are approved as well.
Second.
Three.
All right, then. The minutes will be approved as written for June and September.
Excellent.
Okay, moving on the agenda. Monica, you have a healthcare worker influenza vaccination report?
Yes, I do. So if everybody would turn to page 17, please, of meeting materials. Page numbers are actually on the upper right-hand corner, not the page numbers you see at the bottom. What I did was, our report actually ended up being 77 pages long, so we only published it to our website this year, so you can find it at the HAI website under the tab that's labeled Publications and Maps. There's a link there to the entire 77-page report. So I just produced 6 pages of kind of a summary of what we found in our 2013-2014 influenza season, and we're focusing on healthcare worker influenza vaccination rates. So if you look at my first little bar graph here, it shows you the influenza vaccination percentages for all three seasons, that we've produced the report for so far. Wait, no, sorry, 4 seasons. I was right the first time. You'll see that the first year we didn't have ASCs or ambulatory surgery centers did not report. But over the whole, as far as the Health and Human Services Healthy People goals, hospitals are, for the second year, are the only ones to have met the 77% last year and 82% this year of all Oregon hospitals have met the 2015 Healthy People goal of a 75% healthcare worker vaccination rate, which is very good. If you'll notice there, the blue bar, and they've had a nice steady climb. However, long-term care facilities are poking along there. They've met the 2010 goal, but they're nowhere near yet either the 2015 or the 2020 goal. And then for ASCs as well, not near the 2015 goal, but they have met the 2010 goal the last couple of years. And actually, they had a slight decline in the total percentage of ambulatory surgical center healthcare worker influenza vaccination rates. You'll see there from 70 to 67% last year. The next little chart down below actually looks at just employees. So there's three categories that we looked at in our report. We looked at employees, which are people who get a paycheck directly from the facility. We looked at licensed independent practitioners, and we also looked at another category, lumped together of volunteers and students. So this looks just at employees, the people who are there, we would assume, the most. The first section focuses on hospitals and then long-term care and ambulatory surgery, and again, you can see that it's just a different way of looking at the numbers again, but this time focusing on employees. Hospitals, again, have the nice highest rate, 97% for the 60% goal, which was the healthy people goal for 2010. 80% of all the hospitals have met the 2015 goal, and a pretty good number almost to the 2020 goal of 30%, which I think is excellent. When you're looking at 60 hospitals, that's a pretty good number. For the long-term care, again, they struggle more than the other two types of facilities, with only 29% meeting the 2015 goal, only 9% the 2020 goal, and then ASCs, again, also have a lower number than the other two. Now, the next three pages are always fun to look at. These actually list every facility based on type and their exact overall vaccination rate, which looks at all three types of healthcare workers. We have the four hospitals here that were greater than 90% on the first page, and you can see we have the light green, everybody greater than 75%, which is a 2015 goal, and then the red and the bright red. Bright red would reflect the less than 60% vaccination rate, which is below the 2010 goal.
When you collect this information, if I may ask.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I should
Are you able to find out what behaviors the top performers are instituting or what?
Yes. We'll get to that. Let's see. The last page will show you the types of the reasons that employees decline, as well as the vaccination delivery methods. So we'll look at that a little bit later. But that's an excellent question. Thank you, Mary. The long-term care facilities take up two pages, and you'll notice that on page 20, there's a significant number of long-term care in the light red or the bright red, which is something we'd obviously like to see in the green. And then ambulatory surgery centers, again, you know, if there's a specific facility you're looking at or interested in, again, the bright green, regular green, and the two shades of red. I know the print's kind of small, I'm sorry, but it's on the website, you can make it bigger and see specific facilities. Any questions on those? Yes?
So I see a regional trend in Southern Oregon. They seem to be in the red, their hospitals, all of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. South Bay Three Rivers is 72, then you have Rogue, which is 60 some such, lower Umpqua, of course that's on the coast, but Prov Medford and Ashland coming up, bringing up the rear.
Yeah.
I know that you see regional immunization trends,
mm-hmm.
You know, this aligns with childhood.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the demographics of that area, which makes it even more concerning that the healthcare, not only is the community not vaccinated, but the healthcare workers are vaccinated.
Yes.
I don't know if you have that in your ambulatory surgery centers and everywhere else, but that's
an interesting demographic to look at. We've never actually looked at it regionally before.
This is Jamie Gromadki speaking. This morning, actually, I had the opportunity to present some of this data to the medical staff at Ashland, at our facility there. And just from sort of talking about it and getting information, probably 30 physicians disclosed that they had gotten the immunization and turned that information into us. And a couple immunization right there. So I think there's some work we should do just about educating the providers about informing the state of this information.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's good to know. Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah. No, that's an interesting point. We could look at that next year. I like that. And then our last page of my review on page 22, the first line chart looks at the reasons for vaccination declination. The number one reason is other. Unfortunately, the last 2 years, we used to have a category that was I declined to provide a reason, and you'll see that it's the very bottom bar. There's zeros for 2012 and the 2013 seasons, and that's because it was removed from our survey. So what happened was a lot of those I declines got lumped into the others because they had no other option to mark off out of the different check boxes. And then the second highest reason for declination was philosophical or religious beliefs. In other, they were also allowed to write in reasons that employees gave them that they didn't want to receive the vaccine. And some of the comments that were written in were like, I declined to provide a reason, I don't want it, personal preference, I don't believe the shot works, and just plain, I don't want to say. So it's kind of hard to pin down exactly why those numbers are like that. And then the very bottom, the vaccination delivery methods, I think addresses some of your question, Mary. The number one delivery method for all three types of facilities were no-cost vaccines. However, you'll notice in some of the earlier pages where we have 0%, there were some facilities that did not offer the vaccine at all, whether it was free or not free. They just didn't offer it. Some of the smaller ASCs I noticed didn't do that. Yes, go ahead.
It would be important, too, to know which facilities have mandatory masking policies, because I think that drives a lot of the better rates. I know 12, you know, HSU are pretty high up here, and they both have them.
That's what I was kind of looking for.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I probably want to collect that data. It's pretty important.
Let me write that down.
Do you have a sense of what proportion of facilities have those kinds of policies?
I don't.
Few, and one of the big obstacles would be labor. For the unionized facilities, for some reason, some of the unions are anti-forcing anybody to take vaccine or mask, I should say.
No, that's true. Moving on, hospitals also used a lot of central mass vaccination fairs, vaccination in congregate areas, as well as mobile carts. Sorry, there's a typo there. Not mobile cares, but mobile carts, as well as peer vaccinators. The long-term care facilities focused on occupational health clinics and peer vaccinators. They didn't have, you know, mass vaccination. It's just not conducive to their facility type. And then the ASCs use mainly peer vaccinators and then vaccinations in congregate areas. Any questions on any of this? So this year, you know, in the past, the last 4 years, all we've done is collect this data and spit it out. And this year, we had an excellent suggestion from a couple of facilities saying, you know, I'd really like to share how fabulous we did with our employees, with our administrators. So how about some kind of a kudos? So this year, we've actually decided for those who have met the 2020 HHS goal, the 90% or higher, we're going to send out letters to those facilities in all three types of categories of facilities and actually send out a certificate saying, you know, congratulations, your facility met the HHS goal of 2020 goal of 90% higher vaccination rate, which I think would be helpful, especially to those facilities who are meeting that goal to try to at least stay there. And then we're going to send online letters and recognition to the facilities who met the 2015 goal, which is the 75% vaccination rate. And we're going to put both types of facilities on our website and recognize the individual names of all the facilities also who did that. Now the question is, you know, what can we do to motivate the opposite end of the spectrum? And it's interesting because just today I received a link from APIC that the CDC just put out a new toolkit called the, where did I put it? It actually is a new toolkit on influenza vaccination, and it actually has a bunch of helpful, really helpful ideas for long-term care facilities. It focuses on how to get their influenza vaccination rates higher, some posters that they can print off offline, some specific suggestions to try to increase their rate. I was actually going to talk to Zins again later about this, but I was thinking of sending that link out to everybody with those site, you know, with that information. Maybe that would help them boost their rates, but I'm open to suggestions as well as what you think we should do to help our numbers get higher or ways of recognizing or encouraging.
So when you post it on your website, mm-hmm. I think in the info full transparency, let's put the good and the not so good. Just put them up there, put their rates, just put it out there. And
okay.
Let there be some peer pressure.
So are you suggesting, like, maybe I should just post this entire chart? Something like that? Like these bad boys, like I'm front and center?
Yep.
That would be nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I agree.
Okay.
This is Jamie again in Southern Oregon with Asante. One of the concerns that I've sort of heard repeatedly is the lack of very high quality data that demonstrate that immunizing healthcare workers prevents illness and impacts morbidity and mortality rates. So I think the better job we can do getting that information together and packaging it really helps get the message out to healthcare workers and staff.
It's interesting you bring that up because I spent quite a bit of time this morning perusing that CDC toolkit for the influenza vaccination, and they addressed a lot of that. They had some great research online that you could look at that showed to you how influenza vaccination for healthcare workers greatly impacted the rates of, you know, nosocomial infections. There was some fabulous information in there that I think would be very helpful to facilities who are struggling to get their employees to vaccinate. So.
Well, it would be really helpful if you would be so kind as to maybe just email that to me.
Sure.
We get together, that'd be really helpful for me as we're trying to help our folks get
it. It seems like if you're going to publish this information in full transparency, which I think is a great idea, you could do quick little summaries of what you found on the CDC of two or three references with link to there saying like why this is important, and you know, especially if we're gonna publish everything, so that people who are looking at this, number one, recognize why it's important. Number two, they get a little concerned when some fairly large, well-known hospitals have really low rates, and it's kind of a peer pressure thing. I think it's good.
Okay, excellent idea.
I just also wanted to offer that in addition to, as committee members, it also might be helpful.
This is Mary Post on the phone line.
Yes, Mary. Go ahead, Mary.
You know, I just thought today also of interest is a toolkit to increase immunization rates in long-term care facilities. So that might be a resource tool that you want to put and make available to the long-term care facilities.
Yes, good idea.
That's a great idea. Yeah, what I was going to say is that as committee members, it also seems like a good opportunity that once you get everything posted, we all have opportunities as partners to sort of link to that in our own websites and sort of promote the message. So, for example, the commission is very happy to link to, once you have everything posted, put it in the Worth a Look at our newsletter and other things to make sure that there's support for the message.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Excellent. Thank you.
Monica, I have a question.
Yes.
On page 17, the graph and the table both allude to employees, but the figures on the subsequent pages just list to healthcare workers, and they say overall influenza vaccination percentages. So is that distinction intentional?
Yes.
So these figures that list all the hospitals beginning on page, 18, include not only employees, but other people who meet the CDC definition of healthcare worker.
Right. Okay.
So LIPs, volunteers.
Right.
Okay.
Students. In the report itself, Paul, I have broken out and created these same types of charts for all the different types of employees as well. You'll find it in the appendices. So, like, you'll see hospital LIPs, vaccination rates. And, okay. Any other input? This has been very helpful.
Nice work on this.
Very nice.
Oh, thank you.
Can I just say it's very seasonal, very Christmassy.
Thank you.
Has there been any discussion or move afoot to change some of the requirements that are posed in the OARs regarding vaccination and employers' ability to enforce it as a condition of work?
I don't know. Paul, do you want us to say anything regarding that? You're probably the most
qualified.
You were pushing the minutes.
I was listening, Paul.
Or, yeah, there you go. Mike can do it.
So I'm Michael Tyne, I'm the policy director for the Vision. The answer is yes. I mean, that's something I think we're very interested in. It's not a legislative concept that OHA is carrying forward this legislative session, but if there were external organizations that were interested in supporting something like that, it's probably worth noting that we're the only state in the country that has the law that requires, that not allow employers to require vaccinations for forced employment. So it's right for policy change. I think you have interest for both census program as well as our immunization program. Both boys sort of showed interest in this topic.
Okay, well, thank you. That's good to know.
And there might be some synthetic lawmakers out there, but you know, it would take an external organization to carry the bill or convince a lawmaker. But that's where our role could be, sort of talking about the science, the data, and everything that's come up here.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, is there anything else, Monica?
No, thank you for your time.
Sure. So next on the agenda is the 2012 Central Line Associated Bloodstream Infection Validation Project. The results, Dr. Gusser.
Thank you. So I wanted to be able to present to this group some of the findings that from the CLABSI validation, the Central Line Associated Bloodstream Infection. The validation was completed during 2014, but involved data from 2012. So as I'm sure most of you are very familiar with, central line associated bloodstream infection surveillance is an important component of NHSN, the National Healthcare Safety Network, and has become the focus of a lot of prevention efforts and has helped guide those. And thanks to this, probably, we've seen a dramatic decrease in the number of CLABSIs reported. And these are some U.S. estimates that I got from an MMWR report on this same subject. And so we've, you know, really by focusing on this through surveillance, we've been able to make some dramatic improvements in these types of infections, leading to an estimated $414 million saved and several thousand lives, according to a 2009 report. So ICU CLABSI surveillance has been going on in Oregon since 2009. We began with adult ICUs, and in 2011, NICUs were added. In 2009, we performed a validation, I should say in 2011, they performed, or 12, they performed a validation on 2009 data. And during that validation, what the Oregon Health Authority reviewed a sample, actually did a census of all hospitals in Oregon and did a sampling of their positive blood cultures, and their determinations on whether it was a CLABSI or not was considered the gold standard. When this was compared to facility reporting to NHSN, they calculated a 72% sensitivity, noting that there was underreporting. This led to a rate change of initially an NHSN rate of 1.39, increased slightly to 1.54 ICU CLABSIs per 1,000 central line days. During this validation, there were a lot of lessons learned, especially during the adjudication process, of why there might be errors in classification, both from OHA and from the facility side, and results were fed back to NHSN in order to improve the surveillance process and validation process. So we repeated this, a similar study during 2014, and again, we were set out to validate the NHSN reported events and to look specifically at under and over reporting and adjudicate any discrepant reporting and see what lessons could be learned from that. We calculated sensitivity and specificity and also validated denominator methods. And the way we went about this is we earned a grant to validate the, as you can see on the left, the Central Line Associated Bloodstream Infection Toolkit, validation toolkit that was put out by CDC and NHSN specifically for this purpose. So we, for the most part, followed their methods, and in certain places where we thought we could improve upon them, we did, and gave them feedback as such. Part of it was, in the upper left-hand corner, part of the methods in selecting the blood cultures to be reviewed, they focused on targeted pathogens, like Candida, E. coli, and Staph aureus. In addition, there was a new section on denominator validation where it actually underwent interviews with the different infection preventionists to better understand how they acquired their denominator data. We used a variety of statistics from descriptive to sensitivity and specificity. We did rate calculations and then some categorical summaries of our interview responses. So for the results, in 2009 we had done a census validation, so every hospital had some blood cultures reviewed. In this particular validation, we did a sampling according to the toolkit to identify those hospitals who had higher numbers of positive blood cultures and more likely to find CLAB-C. So overall, of the 41 eligible hospitals, 23 had validation done of blood cultures. 19 of those hospitals were chosen by this targeted sampling method that was described in the toolkit.
Thank you.
An additional four samples were chosen on top of that, or four hospitals were chosen on top of that. Six of the hospitals were academic, and three were critical access. We actually added those four random, the three critical access were actually added to the sample because by the targeted, they actually would have not have been reviewed, but we wanted to make sure that we covered critical access hospitals since they are an important part of our hospitals in Oregon. Among those hospitals, we validated seven ICUs, or NICUs, and as you can see, there's quite a range in numbers from four ICU beds up to 52 with a median of 16, so very different care settings. Overall, 621 charts and 633 events were reviewed. And most of this was done by electronic medical records. There were three hospital systems that we did remotely from here, and then the other ones we traveled to on site. And then after the, I can go to the next slide. So after we had our initial assessment of what we determined to be a CLAB-C or not a CLAB-C, we gave those results to the hospitals, and they had a chance to look at our results and compare and see if they agreed or disagreed with what we had found, and that was called the adjudication process. And we ultimately reviewed 27 charts with the hospitals, and we did this over phone conversations. And they're actually very good conversations because, you know, this is a surveillance system. It's not perfect. It's not necessarily clinical. It doesn't necessarily match the clinical determination. You know, those are some of the limitations of any surveillance system. So we found this is a good moment to understand why had there been this classification, how could maybe the surveillance definitions be improved, etc. Some specific infections were gastrointestinal infections are very complicated, and that came up repeatedly as a very difficult cases to determine. There were some several issues around mismatch of Candida species. So often labs will initially just put out Candida species, and it takes longer to speciate whether it has to be sent out to another lab. And so that led to some misclassification of whether there was matching or not matching organisms. There was a couple location of attributions. Some of that was also from our side because we were only looking at the hospital's charts, and if it was lacking about transfer information, we wouldn't have seen that. And then we also discovered a data error in that we weren't able to quote-unquote see some of the CLAB-Cs that had been reported by facilities didn't come over to our side on NHSN. So that's why it was very useful. So overall, in OHSA, we identified 53 CLAB-Cs. And NHSN reported 44 CLAB-Cs, that was reported by the facilities, and this led to an underreporting of 23%, which is consistent with the previous validation. Next slide. And then we did some sensitivity and specificity analysis, and overall the sensitivity was 77% for a facility to report what was considered to be a true CLAB-C into NHSN, and the specificity was very high. And I should say those were the post-adjudication results after all the details had been worked out. And then overall, here's a listing of the hospitals are just random or given numbers on the left axis, and the rate along the bottom is the number of ICU CLAB seats per 1,000 central line days. And here is just to show you the variety of CLAB seats seen across all of our different care settings. From 0 up to 4.5 ICU CLAB-Cs per 1,000 central line days. And this is from, again, just the 23 hospitals that were involved.
Genevieve?
But very similar to last
time. I have a question. Can you go back a couple of slides?
Sure.
We had the CLAB-C validation, the number of underreporting.
Mm-hmm.
Am I not reading this right? Wouldn't that be 9 instead of 12? If you have 44 and you're going to 53?
Yeah, it's more complicated than that because some of them we said yes, and there's also under and over reporting.
Okay, so that
part
was
of that,
a final determination.
That was a final determination.
Okay, so
that's why it's not a true
first glance reaction.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I probably should have mentioned something to that effect, but that depending on which category they changed into. So thank you for seeing that. So this is, I'll just take a pause for a moment on this slide here. So this is facility reported versus validated ICU CLABSI rates in Oregon. And I've taken data from 2009 to 2013. And on the left axis shows the rate of CLABSIs per 1,000 central line days. And shown on the graph, so the blue line on the bottom is the NHSN reported CLABSI rate. And then the yellow, the two individual yellow triangles are the two validated rates that were determined for validation for ICU CLABSIs. This doesn't include NICUs. And then the two trend lines kind of shows a general, those were made, calculated as general trend lines. So you can see that that there is a discrepancy, or there is seems to be a difference between validation and reported. However, of course, we don't know what happened in the interim years, and it may not always be a large or a small difference. But just to show the importance of validation, not to go around and say, oh, you guys did it wrong or whatever, but just to understand our data and to check our data, and it's important to do this with any kind of surveillance system. And the next slide is, I also pulled this data out here. This is CLABSI denominator and numerator trends. So basically, to orient you to the slide, on the left is the denominator count. So that is central line and patient days. And on the right, the central line days are the yellow or the lowest line, and the patient days are the blue line, which happens to be the top line if you're not in a color version of this. And then on the right-hand side is the numerator count. So that's the number of CLABSIs. So just looking at this over the 4 years, you can see that the central line days haven't really changed very much over time. And this is for all the NHSN data, so not just more than the 23 hospitals, but for the hospitals reporting in. And the patient days has come down a tad, but the CLABSI rate truly has come down. So I think this just really exemplifies that the exposures aren't changing too much. Maybe there's fewer patient days, but the central line days are staying the same. So exposure for risk is still there, but we're doing a better job at preventing CLABSI. So I thought this was... I hope this kind of illustrates a little bit about the progress that's been made after everybody's hard work.
Is that validated or not validated?
That's not validated. These are just the NHS.
So that would go up actually for that last year, right? The CLABSI rate.
Right, but in general, there has been, even if you went up, it says 33 if you went up to 50, but it's still coming down from 2009. So, but I kept the unvalidated data so we can look at what we have so far. If you change to the validated data, it would come up a little bit, but better than 2009. And again, we don't have validated data in between, so it's possible that that was still coming down once we were validating the data. So try not to mix my data sources too much. This is non-validated data. So then moving on to the interviews, just to give you a sense of what this sample of hospitals is doing around the state, as far as collecting central line days, it's fairly split actually still between electronic and, now I'm going to take that back. There's actually most of the hospitals here are still doing the manual, whether it's by the unit nursing staff or another person on the unit, and some have done electronic denominator data. And that's especially the central line days. There were a lot of discussions on how difficult that was to validate and how difficult it is to make a system get it right every time. And so most of the hospitals have still do it by a trained unit staff in order to be more accurate. And that's different than the patient days, which actually most of that is automated and usually through accounting services that provides them with a daily number. This is the asked some questions about the quality control of central line data. So basically asking the infection preventionist at the facility, do they do any internal validation of their central line data? And a third said not really. There's no routine internal validation, but two-thirds of them did have some sort of regular way of rechecking internally their data. And the emphasis on this is that the external data validation is very difficult and time-consuming to do, so we do really rely upon facilities to do their own internal validation along the way. One piece that came up frequently in our conversations was how to count ports. These are difficult because, if they're not accessed, they're not counted, and once they become accessed, they're counted for the entire stay, and that can be a real challenge for, say, an electronic system to capture. So had some good conversations and teaching around that. So in overall, Well, we like to think that surveillance saves lives and brings people attention to problems. And when just as in the public display of data around healthcare worker vaccination rates, we hope that that will get people to pay attention to that as well. Our NHSN reporting sensitivity is fair, but I should say that this is really on par with most of the NHSN sensitivity reports in different states around the United States. That sort of 70 to 80% is pretty much what most systems do, to give you a sense of comparison. Overall, it does look like there's a decrease looking at both validated and unvalidated data in our rates of CLABSIs in Oregon, so that is great to see. And that, you know, despite not seeing much of a change in the central line days going on. And then just what last points I talked about, how a lot of manual data collection is still going on, especially for the central line and device days, but that the patient days is usually automatic. And how we'd like to see some better internal validation of the denominator data. So I'd just like to thank a lot of the people that worked on this, Valerie Ocampo, Diane Roy, who helped build the database, Steve Robeson helped with some of the other statistics that we did with this data, and of course Vince, and all of the hospitals that were just great and the departments that welcomed us and make it possible, along with the CDC team. So happy to take any questions on what we found.
Question for you.
Sure.
So you said in the beginning that this was data from 23 hospitals, is that right?
Correct.
Right. So the learnings that you have, and you shared a lot with the hospitals that you were engaged with, so what about sharing the broader, the learnings more broadly with all hospitals that do this? What's the plan?
So the plan for that is we have a report that will be going. It's not the full report that we turned to the CDC, but a synopsis of the report that will be posted to the website along with the protocol that was for the data. So the protocol's there, and I think we just have to do some final, you know, looking at the shortened report that will summarize the data that was found.
So is
including
the timeline,
cost and everything like that. I would say probably next month. I mean, it's mostly there. It's just a matter of calling out sort of like Monica did with the talking points for each piece and giving context to it. But the protocol's already up there.
Okay.
And the results. And all the results have been given back to the facilities that participated.
And I mean, I think we'd also like to probably present at some other places, like the AVIC meeting, most likely. I guess you would be interested.
The more the merrier.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot of this information, hospital infection preventionists would like to have that to share at their meetings and with staff that are responsible for this.
Yeah. No, we just have to go through some internal.
I have a question. And looking at the range between 0 and, was it 4.5? Or that's a big range to calculate an average on, so.
Right. No, and there's a lot of, I mean, and that's why the total CLABSI validation rate, you have to take that with a grain of salt, and this, even the CDC doesn't like to do too much aggregation, just because each facility type is different. So this is really, the most important thing is for those facilities who were part of the previous validation and this one, they can look at how their validated results for their own facilities changed internally is the most valuable piece to take away. So that information was provided back to the facility along with the sensitivity and specificity. Yeah.
And Jen, did you get a sense when talking to the IEPs of how they primarily use this data? Was it more for sort of internal benchmarking year to year, or were they really concerned with how they looked on a public report or they share with
them? I think that there was a lot of motivation not to have a central line associated bloodstream infection because not all, but many of the hospitals had real-time response to them. So if there was a CLABSI, you know, emails went out, there was a root cause analysis. So a few of the hospitals did that. So there was, you know, a real desire to identify those and then figure out what went wrong and try to correct it. Other hospitals, there was much more of a lag time to reviewing those cases and identifying the CLABSI. So there wasn't as much attention to it in the moment, but I think that overall the knowledge was there, like the important understanding of importance of CLABSIs and ways that had been put into place and how to decrease those. So I don't know how much the public reporting versus just reporting internally to their own like administration, how the variability of that, but I'd say both were there.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about, I don't know if I missed it, but there are patients who have central lines because they're really sick and they're in the hospital and they don't happen to have neutropenia and cancer and all those things that predispose to infection. And so I imagine, every one of these patients obviously was identified. So what's the split between people who would be very I mean, some of them come in with a central line infection because they're neutropenic from chemotherapy and stuff, as opposed to somebody who was in an accident and they have a central line, and then during the course of their hospitalization, they get a CLABSI, which they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Right. There weren't actually that many people from the first that you mentioned that were neutropenic, and or they would have been ruled out right when they came in, present on admission, if that's what you needed.
Well, maybe they wouldn't, because sometimes they're admitted for low platelet count, and they happen to have a port. They have a central line where they get chemo, and then their white cell drops and so forth. So what I'm saying is, if I were that the 4.52, I'd be saying, hold on just a second, we've got half of these are critically ill neutropenic patients who we can do all the hand washing and everything else,
but
they're going to pick up infections.
Well, NHSN, so the standard infection ratio, I mean, there are normalization calculations that are done based upon the acuity of the hospital, their academic, the number of beds, the type of patients that they're done, and so that's part of the NHSN validation. But there weren't that many folks that sort of fell into that neutropenic port. I mean, that necessarily would have been, or they would have, if there's a surveillance piece that they, definition that they would have fallen into, that would have taken them out of being a true CLABSI, okay. Then that would have happened.
Yeah, I just think there are two groups, this immunodeficiency and neutropenia group, and then there's everybody else.
Right.
Yeah,
mucosal barrier injury. Exactly.
That's the more current one.
They're still not excluded in this data.
They're still locked in.
That is a concern that CDC recognized. So in the updated definitions, they're actually going to get those people.
And part of the surveillance process, I mean, you identify the positive blood culture, but then you basically are just trying to say, oh, this must be due to something else besides the CLABSI. So you look for pneumonias or gastrointestinal or other things,
right.
And then if it doesn't apply to any of those, then you're left with the CLABSI. And although they do exist, those neutropenic patients, they weren't that common actually.
Okay.
Any other questions for Dr. Buser?
Thank you
very much. So moving on to an object of every hospital's intense interest is CDI validation project. Kate will be presenting.
Great, and for those of for you guys on the phone, in your in the meeting materials, this should start on page 43. You guys have a big packet. For people in this room, the handout, it's on page 27 in the upper left-hand corner if you want to take notes. But this is sort of interesting following Jen's presentation on CLABSI, because I think C. diff and CLABSI are sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of what we know about surveillance, how comfortable people are with the metrics and validation. C. diff reporting is sort of new to Oregon and also just newer than CLABSI, so it brings up a whole host of different types of issues. So just for background on CDI, Clostridium difficile infection, laboratory-identified events are reportable through our Oregon mandatory reporting program, as you guys know, since this was a decision that was made by this group. For all hospitals starting 2013 and then coming up in January 2015, our one LTAC will be on board as well. The requirement is just for facility-wide reporting, so we consider all laboratory-identified C. diffs, except for those coming out of locations that primarily serve infants. So that NHSN has sort of an 80% rule. So if a location has 80% infants, like a NICU or well baby, those guys aren't considered in the numerator or denominator. So some of the unique things about lab ID reporting through NHSN. Include the fact that it's really defined by microdata and by administrative data. So very different than an IP coming up with the NHSN HAI classification. There's no clinical criteria used at all. And this is really sort of an effort to, on CDC's behalf, to respond to feedback about the burden of surveillance reporting. So it's a double-edged sword. It definitely decreases burden, but then may increase some uncertainty. And that's really what we're trying to get at with some of these validation projects. So rates and SIRs are calculated using patient days as a denominator, which is different from CLABSI's current central line days.
So just to kind of briefly, without getting into the weeds too much about the NHSN definition, I think it's important to know that there are kind of two main steps to classifying a C. diff infection as an incident hospital onset event that we care about that's going to be reported publicly. And so the first is really identifying this lab ID event as reportable. So this is kind of the IP's job. So they look through microdata and determine the first positive C. diff specimen for a patient in a particular location. It has to be the first one in 14 days. They also classify non-duplicate recurrent events. So those are CDI with onset at least 14 days after the previous lab ID event. So basically, that's the IP's job, is really just categorizing these as NHSN reportable or not, going through. And then basically all of the classification as community onset, hospital onset, recurrent or incident, that's done by the NHSN system itself. So community onset lab ID events are reported, and that actually becomes important in risk adjustment. We want to know what the prevalence is at hospitals. The hospital onset lab ID events are positive CDI specimens collected on or after day 4 in a patient that hasn't had one for 14 days. And then there's the definitions for incident and recurrent. So to be considered an incident hospital onset infection, you can't have had a CDI within the last 8 weeks. And so again, the reported rates in SIRs, the stuff that's going to appear in public reports, is this hospital onset incident event. So the main metric used for public reporting of CDI lab ID is the standardized infection ratio. And this is, we had talked about some of the issues with using straight rates in the last presentation, and I think the same thing happens here. Certain facilities are likely to have more CDI infections because of their prevalence. So of course we look at the observed events, and then the expected number is actually calculated by a number of hospital-specific factors. So, of course, number of patient days, that's always the main adjuster. Type of testing, so if the hospital is doing PCR testing, we want to know that, and that's gathered through a question on the annual survey. The community onset prevalence rate, what's the transmission pressure at this hospital, that's taken into account. And bed size and medical school affiliation are really used as proxies for patient severity. So just, I kind of wanted to quickly, show you sort of how CDI is reported now, and we'll get into this a little bit later in another presentation, but this is how it looks in our current 2013 report. So we see, hospitals listed individually, number of observed infections, number of expected infections, the SIR, and then our triangle legend about whether that's significantly different than one, and in what direction. Information is also available on our recently published clickable map. So this was created by Magdalena Scott on our team. And so there's a lot of, if you click on the CDI tab on this map, and we went over it at the last meeting, but that you can actually hover over each facility's either CDI rates, number of infections, number of patient days, number of expected infections, and really kind of drill down. This data is also publicly reported as of 2013 on CMS Hospital Compare. So I just actually picked a couple of, I don't know why that one should be red, the little 1.317. I just picked three hospitals from Oregon and pushed Compare, and this is the kind of data that pops up. So you're seeing the SIR, the confidence level around it, et cetera. So, I think probably from seeing those slides, it's obvious why we would want to validate this data. It's out there. People are can use it to make decisions or it can put pressure on hospitals. And we want to kind of understand sources of systematic bias. Is it fair to be comparing hospitals as we're currently doing? And if not, what can we do to make these comparisons fairer? Another reason why it's important to do this is that CDC is actually paying us to do this through a grant that was partially funded to look at CDI reporting in Oregon. So we had partial funding during this 14-15 grant cycle, and CDC is in the process of modifying their protocol. So just like they want all the feedback from Jen and her team in that project, they also want feedback from us how well our protocol is working. And I think it's important to know that they actually are considering modification of certain risk adjustment protocols for CDI. There's some talk that it might not be complete, that some things like patient age are very important, and that's not taken into account. So there's a lot that we sort of don't know and a lot of reasons to validate this data. So before we started planning our protocol, we looked at what's already been done, and New York State has been pretty aggressive in terms of trying to validate this data off the bat. So before they made CDI lab ID reportable, they did a study that compared lab ID rates to a definition that was based on clinical surveillance and really intense scrutiny of patient records and information coming from other facilities in some cases. And they actually found that sort of that there was an upward bias. So these the rates that we see in the lab ID are actually about 30% higher. And I think a lot of that comes from not having information about patient that was community onset, prevalent on admission. They maybe get that specimen collected on day four and they look like they're hospital onset. But their conclusion was, well, there's sort of this bias across hospitals, and it's kind of funny when you read the conclusion of their abstract because it's just like, so we thought it was okay for public reporting. You know, it's not very enthusiastic, but that's there. So then once they started doing this lab ID, they did another study that was really well done where they looked at all kinds of sources of bias. They looked at, you know, how was the IP reporting to NHSN? What was the influence of excluding data from outside hospitals? Because remember, you're just looking at the data, the micro data from your one hospital. And they also were interested in, you know, we look at patient days as the denominator. Should we be looking at patient days at risk? I'll talk about this in a minute, but they wanted to know what was the impact. And they really actually found minimal impact of, NHSN classification. The IPs were doing pretty much what they should have been doing according to the NHSN definition. And they didn't find that big of an impact of data from other hospitals, but they found that there was a huge impact of taking out patient data that were not at risk. So we'll get into this. So the CDC denominator for lab ID data is all patient days except for the NICUs, the well baby units, etc. But if you think about a patient's stay and the CDI definition, there are certain periods during that stay when they're not actually at risk. They can't actually meet the definition for hospital onset infection. So days 1 through 3 with admission on day 1, they're not really at risk. They can't possibly meet the definition. And also, if they do meet criteria, say on day 5, then for the next 8 weeks, they can't also meet that definition. So, so you have a lot of patient days that are in there that probably shouldn't be. This wouldn't be a problem if all hospitals had sort of similar lengths of stay, but were sort of a bias that we thought were similar across all hospitals. But what the New York study found is that that there were biases towards, for hospitals with longer lengths of stay, their rates sort of appeared a lot higher when they did this. Because you can imagine if a hospital has an average length of stay of 4 or 5 days, then the majority of their patient days are coming from patient days that are really not at risk. So that's sort of an interesting thing. It's not part of the CDC validation protocol, but we're kind of interested, would that have an impact on rates and SIRs and rankings of our Oregon hospitals? We sort of have our validation protocol that we're finalizing right now. We'd like to study 3 sources of bias in the lab ID data. So the first is really how well do the IPs do at classifying lab ID events. So we're going to look at this in a sample of 19 hospitals in 5 counties. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail about the sampling now, but it's basically a convenient sample due to some of our resource constraints. And this is kind of where our group is also doing some CDI prevention work, so we really want to understand what's going on there. We're going to use the CDC protocol, and our reviewers will just review the same things that the IPs presumably reviewed and calculate rates. The second thing we're going to do in a smaller sample of 3 hospitals is look at data from surrounding long-term care facilities and outpatient clinics. So at 3 of the hospitals where we're doing some prevention work, and also one of the hospitals in Klamath County where we have an EIP site, we have access to sort of this enhanced pool of data about patients and their CDI status prior to admission to a hospital. So we're going to do an in-depth review of that data, and then kind of calculate rates and SIRs and see what the differences are once we have access to that kind of data. And then the third sort of arm of this validation is going to be looking at that patient day issue here in Oregon. And one of the ways we can get to this data is to use hospital discharge data to approximate patient days at risk. And we can do that for all of our reporting facilities. And then we'll calculate and compare and see what kind of impact it has here in Oregon. So this is just kind of trying to look at the 3 layers, sort of the internal IP validation, and then looking at information from external facilities, and then kind of the bigger circle is, you know, when we calculate these metrics across all hospitals, what kind of shortcomings do we have? So that's sort of, in a nutshell, our plan. I know a lot of details were left out, but just wanted to make you aware of that, those efforts.
What's the timeline?
We actually have letters going out to CEOs and IPs at the end of the week to start the protocol. We're trying to validate between February 15th and April 15th. This one will hopefully be on site or reviewing remotely with a report that's sometime in probably, I think, mid to late summer.
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, because the grant runs out July 31st. So.
Okay.
You're looking at outside facilities as well, so how are you going to determine the burden, say, from long-term care? How? Is that just lab? Should they test it?
Data. I mean, this is sort of part of to talk a little bit about the protocol. We're trying to do some intense prevention work, and so I think part of that will be actually getting into the records and looking at CDI burden. And in long-term care facilities, which is a focus.
And one of the issues is kind of inter facility transfer and kind of trying to determine transmission patterns and whatnot. So we can present that probably in a future. We're still developing that protocol. But
yeah, the idea would be to pick spots that there's a long-term care facility feeding into a hospital and then dive down into that and really try to understand the burden, the transfer, the amount of, transmission.
Yeah, interesting. I just wonder how readily available that information would be, and how often long-term care facilities would test antibiotic-associated diarrhea or C. diff.
It's pretty well standard to test for it. And the shortcomings part, real briefly, would be culture versus toxin lab test, and treatment based on the culture positive versus toxin. And so there is some definition confusion that you all can straighten out.
Right, and I'd say most labs are testing for toxin and not just for culture. The culture is more used if you're doing, say, you're looking at asymptomatic carriers and you want to pick it up that way versus toxin. But yeah, and the different testing methods, the EIA versus PCR, there's definitely different sensitivities. So I might just segue very quickly into looking specifically at that question and others. We're going to be doing a survey for laboratories and also for hospitals and skilled nursing facilities, asking them about their C. diff testing practices, which lab they testing they use, and that will help answer that question of sensitivity and specificity for identification.
Any other comments or questions for C. diff? I know that hospitals, and I'll speak for myself, are very interested in because everybody has to, this time of year, establish goals and targets. And of course, C. diff is on the radar at every hospital. And it's very hard using SIRS. So the raw data, the aggregated raw data, with the rates per 10,000 patient days, is essentially how we would establish our rates. So it'd be really nice to have kind of a range for Oregon. Where are we and where do we sit with the rest of the country? And what would be a good targeted rate? I mean, using your internal benchmarking, but just to see where you are, if you're good, better, or need to improve. Okay, so, and next on the list, OAR updates. Monica.
Yes, since we're running a little behind, I'll be quick. Just don't want to beat a dead horse. You all reviewed our proposed changes to our Oregon administrative rules. I believe it was 2 weeks ago we sent out the email about it. Basically, the reasoning behind us making any changes to the OARs is to be online with CMS reporting. And so we don't want to ask facilities to report above and beyond what CMS is asking them to report. So the first thing that we are proposing, or did propose, and is going to be going to legislature next year, is the Surgical Care Improvement Project. There were skip measures 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 9, and 10 that were, when we originally started reporting, most of those have been dropped. In 2012, CMS stopped collecting skip measure number 6, and at the end of this year, they're going to stop collecting numbers 1, 2, 3, and 9, I believe. I'm sorry, I have this written down. So the only thing, 1, 2, 3, and 9, so the only two that will remain will be number 4 and number 10. And if you're interested, number 4 is the one that refers to controlled blood post-op blood sugar at 6 o'clock in the next morning. And number 10 is the one with temperature management after surgery. So we didn't want to ask our Oregon facilities to continue to report to us something they're not having to report anymore to CMS. That's the first change. The second change was CMS is going to require dialysis facilities and inpatient psychiatric facilities to report influenza vaccination numbers of their healthcare workers. So, of course, we'd love to see that data as well. So we requested to change our OARs to see this data that they're already putting into NHSN so we can report on it as well for those facilities.
Monica, this is Dana. I'm sorry, I meant to get back to you, but I figured I was going to be here anyway.
Yeah.
So quick note, there is no such thing as an inpatient psychiatric care facility in our statute.
Okay.
You need to say a hospital that offers inpatient psychiatric services, maybe, or we need to rephrase that because that... I looked it up again.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the facilities that we discussed, Oregon State Hospital and...
Right, but they're not that term.
Right,
It doesn't exist.
Okay.
So it may be for CMS, which is charming.
Right.
Whatever. But, but I'll get with you on
that's
the
fine.
Definition. We'll just make it accurate.
Yeah.
And everybody will,
great.
Something good. Offline. Appreciate
that.
You don't need to do it here. I just want to...
No, thank you. I appreciate that. So, just wanted to remind everybody about those changes, a short sweet, if you had any questions about it. We're going to have our public hearing, actually, January 20th, if you want to join me, at 1:30 in this room. Generally, nobody shows up, and I'm hoping that's the case as well, since Vince won't be here. He'll be hiking somewhere in Patagonia, but if you're nothing else to do, you're welcome to join me.
Thank you very much, Monica. So moving along into overview of OIR mandated surveys, Dr. Booser.
Okay, the last bit, and I mentioned this before, and you'll find that on the next few pages of your handout, like 30, 31, 32, are posters describing the survey that we'll be sending out probably in mid-January or so. There'll be a web-based survey, and it'll be going to hospital infection preventionists, laboratories that do bacteriology, and thirdly, skilled nursing facilities. And we had done this survey back in 2012, so we're repeating it this year. Some of the topics will be the same, so we're asking about carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, but we've added a Clostridium difficile component to try to reflect this year where we're really doing a lot of focus on C. diff work. And then there's some general sort of capacity resource questions. Especially the long-term care facility one, we've tried to build that out a little bit like the NHSN long-term care facility survey that will be starting, I think, next year or the year after with NHSN to kind of start collecting some of that information to understand about what infection control resources our long-term care facility, or specifically our skilled nursing facilities, have in Oregon. So right now we're in the process of piloting this, and then it'll come out early next year. So any more questions, feel free to ask.
And in your packets for those guys in this room, it's on page 30 is a flyer that Jen puts together for the hospital survey, and then the next two pages have for lab.
Yeah, and we're going to be sending these out to the labs, and we've given them to some of for the skilled nursing facilities, we've given them to some of our stakeholders to distribute, and then we will be sending next week them out to the infection preventionists just to give them a heads up.
And for those guys on the phone, the flyers we were talking about are on page 56 for your packet. Does anyone on the phone have any questions or comments?
No questions here from Southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm. I have none from Tillamook.
Okay, so how's time?
Mary, I don't have any questions.
Okay. So we're at 205 right now, 206.
Okay.
I think, I'm next on the agenda, so I know people kind of are flying in here from various things, so why don't we just meet at 110?
210?
Or sorry, 210? 110. And pick up again. Okay, guys, I love hearing all of these conversations because I think this is like part of what this meeting is all about is really networking, and I've heard a lot of really interesting questions and comments about reporting. And this next half hour, actually, I'd like to be very sort of interactive. We're going to be talking about sort of the state of public reporting in Oregon, some of our ideas for kind of the 2014 report, and so we'd love to hear what you have to say. So definitely don't see this as like some really didactic presentation where you have to sit and take notes. So at the beginning, I know a lot of people sort of like filtered in and we got started right away, so I was wondering if we could just first go around and introduce ourselves. I think most of us know most people, but I think there might be a few people who are new to us. So let's start with Zintz and end with the folks on the phone.
So I'm Zintz Beldavs. I manage the HAI program here at the Oregon Health Authority.
I'm Pat Preston. I'm an independent infection control consultant for the long-term care industry. And having served 3 years as a committee member, I now serve as the small business interest for long-term care.
Mary Shanks, infection control from Kaiser Westside.
Rachel Potensky, infectious disease from Providence St. Vincent Hospital.
Bethany Wamsley, the executive director for the Oregon Patient Safety Commission.
Diane Waldo, vice president of quality, Oregon Hospital Association.
I'm Nancy O'Connor, and I've been on this committee for several years. I was a past chair, and I just recently changed positions. So you may have known me before as the manager of infection prevention and employee health at Salem Health. And as of Monday, I'm the regional director of infection prevention for Providence Health Systems.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Is she your
co-worker? Yeah.
Yes. I'm Joan Baca. I'm the director of nursing at Life Care Center Mapleville, and I'm the long-term representative.
I'm Dana Silver. I'm we're at Public Health Division. I'm the section manager for healthcare regulation quality improvement, and I'm here with my regulation and my quality improvement hat on. We regulate hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, and a whole bunch of other things, including EMS and trauma hospitals.
I'm Kelly Coyle. I'm ambulatory surgery center. I'm the director there, and I'm representing the ambulatory surgery center.
Paul C. Slack. I'm the medical director for communicable diseases here at the Public Health Division.
I'm Carl Brown from the Oregon Nurses Association.
I'm Chubb O'Meara. I'm Deputy Chief Medical Officer for Cambia Health Solutions and also the Executive Medical Director for the Oregon Blue Cross Blue Shield Plan.
I'm Genevieve Buser and one of the public health physicians at the Acute and Communicable Diseases.
And I'm Monica Samper, registered nurse and the HAI reporting coordinator. I drew a blank, sorry.
And how about folks on the phone?
This is Jamie Grabowski. I'm a family doc and I'm VPMA at Rogue and Ashland Hospitals in Southern Oregon.
Hey.
This is Julie Bontanelli. I'm the director of CIS and quality at Tillamook Regional Medical Center and Critical Access Hospital and the infection prevention nurse does report to me and unfortunately she's on leave, so I am covering for her. So I may have to leave the meeting earlier for a concern out here. Okay,
thank you.
This is Mary Close, Director of Infection Prevention at the Oregon Patient Safety Commission.
Okay, great. I think we got everybody on the phone. All right, and for those of you guys, those of you joining by phone, in your packet, we're going to start with the slides on page 56 in the upper left-hand corner. And for everybody in the room, you've got the slides, but if you want to take notes or something, these slides start on page 33 in the upper left-hand corner. Okay, so like I said, I'm going to actually sort of go through a little bit of background and try to sort of set the stage for where we are in terms of public reporting. I know everybody knows what the statutes are and you've passed all the laws, but I don't know, as someone who started here recently, I find myself constantly like, oh wait, what was reportable when and how long has that been reportable? And it's just hard to kind of wrap your head around, like, just the amazing amount of data that we actually now have access to. And it's really sort of blossomed, I think, in the last few years. So we'll talk sort of about the big picture. And what I'd love to get out of this conversation is some feedback from you guys about how we can make the annual report sort of actionable, readable, useful, and how it fits into the context of the other places where the same data is reported. We've got now sort of this clickable map, we have Hospital Compare, and then we have the annual report. So we're trying to figure out what fits where, I think will be sort of an ongoing goal even after this report comes out. And I'd like to end by talking a little bit about the inclusion of a new HAI metric. So I just want to get your feedback on a metric that CDC has been working on for assessing hospital burden. We talk about SIRs a lot, which is, an incident rate ratio. That doesn't tell us a lot about the burden of infection in a hospital. It tells us sort of, did they have more than we expected them to have? But that could mean they had 2 more than we expected them to have, or 90 more, and we don't really know. And so that's kind of where we're going. And so we may not be including it in next year's report, but I think we could potentially use it to kind of understand which hospitals, maybe need the most attention prevention-wise. So this is just the big picture where we are. There's a lot going on here. Obviously, we have sort of CLABSI reporting that's been ongoing, and then we've got the new addition of wards, which we were talking about at the break. That's coming up in January 2015. They're going to start reporting to us. Then there's CAUTI, which is going to be something new in this 2014 report, and you can see all the different surgical infections. CDI, lab ID events, we started reporting last year, so this year we'll actually have some data. We'll be able to make some more comparisons year to year. MRSA bacteremia is something new for us this year. That's something we'll be reporting out. Skip measure adherence, Monica alluded to. There's been a lot of changes and additions and subtractions, so we actually have a slide in here, which I kind of asked you guys what we should do about that. We have some thoughts, but we want to hear from you guys. And then healthcare worker vaccination obviously has been going on in hospitals since the beginning. So in terms of mandatory reporting at non-hospital settings, just in case people don't have this sort of at the top of their heads right now, I can't imagine why you wouldn't, but we have dialysis event data, which that last year was the first year we reported out on that. And so it was a little bit, we weren't sure exactly how to do it. We basically just published the rates and compared them to the national rate, not statistically, but that's sort of what we had to work with last year. Healthcare worker vaccination is going to be new in dialysis facilities, part of the OAR changes Monica alluded to. Long-term care facilities, technically, they are required to report to OHA MDS requirements. Now, this doesn't require any extra effort from them. They're already reporting to CMS, but that counts as they're sort of meeting the mandate to report to us. And we haven't done anything with this data, because I know we talked to both for long-term care people at the break. We'd like to hear from you about feedback on that, either during the session or later too. Just ideas about how we might include this in the report. And then inpatient rehabilitation is actually coming on board as well next year. So kind of, overall there's a lot of data. And so, figuring out how to put this into a report is a challenge. And so there are just a few things. We'll return to this slide later, but as we're kind of going through what the report looks like now and the other sources of information, it would be helpful for you guys to think about or give me feedback on, what you think the scope of the annual report should be. So, should we do all infections, all metrics? Should it be like a comprehensive report? Should it be executive summary style? Excuse me. Should we, work on different reports for different settings, et cetera? And this is sort of the report from last year, which I just want to take my hat off to Diana Applegate, who did an amazing job with putting together a lot of information. And she worked really hard on this report, and I think that she tried to respond to feedback from last year, and I think there's been some more feedback about how we might sort of make this more streamlined or usable. So that's what we're working towards. So some specifics, you know, I think a lot of what's published in this report and online really encourages us to compare facilities by SIR. I mean, it does. Like Hospital Compare ranks them, like our report ranks them by SIR. And is that what we want to be doing? You know, we sort of are implicitly, even if we don't say it outright. Do we want to provide some context for people when they're interpreting this data, et cetera? Should we be kind of encouraging facilities to do more intra-facility comparison over time, like more benchmarking? And should we be incorporating our validation findings into the report, and if so, how? You know, we didn't talk about, in this report, we didn't mention anything about the CLASI work that's been done, but I think that actually it might be worthy of a place in this report. I mean, I think it is, but sort of how we do it is still a question. And then, you know, finally, like, we sort of touched on this with the healthcare worker vaccination. Do we highlight facilities that are doing better than expected? How do we help facilities doing worse than expected? This is sort of like, I feel like we're kind of at a critical point where now we're collecting all this data and it's time to figure out what we're going to do with it. And so I think you guys are just glad everyone's gathered here to help us figure this out. So where, once the facilities collect all this data, where does it go? And you know, we've already sort of mentioned this, that the OHA and the MAP are facility level data. CDC puts out an annual report. So Oregon is like, you know, 2 pages of that report where they talk about all our metrics and we are compared to other states, et cetera. So it's important to know that that's out there. And then CMS Hospital Compare, obviously. So this is a report. And we have, we basically combined for last year for hospitals, like all the infections, the SCIP measures, and then we report the dialysis data as well as healthcare worker vaccination data. And you guys probably saw a link go out to the most recent healthcare worker vaccination report that Monica just discussed. That actually was published as a separate report. So what would go in the upcoming 2014 report would be like a summary of that report. So the question arises, do we want to keep that summary in the report, keep it separate? Those are all options to consider. And so this is all kind of leading up to some very specific feedback that I'd like to get from you guys. But in case you haven't, you know, you don't read this before you go to bed at night, here's, this is sort of what it looks like now. And it's a little strange that the colors aren't, they're not really showing on this very well. Yeah, it's like the yellow is...
Oh, it's weird though, it almost looks like how I would prefer it in terms of the clear ones, yeah. The light green end up being clear.
Yeah, so I guess the, we basically have some, like a dark green triangle, which looks yellow there. This is gonna get so confusing. But that means that it's significantly less than one. And then we have sort of these lighter triangles to show that they're less than one, but not significantly so. So you can see like on the right side, we actually compare hospitals by SIR. I'll just pick this. So these guys like are all, this dark yellow are significantly better, significantly lower than one, so they're doing better. The dark red are significantly higher than one, and they're doing better. But we still rank everybody based on SIR, whether or not they're statistically significant. That's sort of the main take home. So then the other ways we look at the annual report is sort of, we compare SIRs from year to year. So this is like a CDIF example. And then we also have some forest plots which show the 95% confidence intervals. So I think this is like Diana's effort last year to say a lot of people want to see this data in a lot of different ways, so let's just put it all in there. And so we could do that again, or we could sort of decide as a group what's the most useful way to see the data and stick with, you know, maybe a more concise or compact reporting. So here's influenza vaccination rates. You guys have already seen those and sort of our red-green display. And then this is kind of how dialysis rates are reported again. So again, we just have the number of infections and then an arrow up or down. Okay, so here's the Surgical Care Improvement Project. This is kind of one of my first specific questions for you guys. So if you look at these rates, like first of all, most of these are not going to be there in a year. Like we're going to get rid of these. So the question that leaves the you know, glucose control for the facilities performing CABGs, which are all over 90%, and then thermoregulation, which is 100% across the board, maybe 99%. So I mean, I personally don't see a lot of utility in this data, but I mean, I don't know. Like, should we continue to put it in our report? Just, I mean, is it helpful to know that people are at 100% or
at 99?
I think the skip measures have been around, and Diane, you can probably attest to this, for a long time, and have been on hospital radars for a long time, mm-hmm. and are constantly looked at, and if they're not meeting target, then things are happening.
Okay. So at least it's they're meeting target.
So does that mean they're useful, or that we don't need to look at
we
them?
We don't need to look at them because everybody else is in,
okay.
In the hospital.
I'm sorry about the color here. It's really like super messed up.
Yeah, it looks nice on here.
Yeah, it looks perfect on my screen.
Usually
nobody
it's
can
the
see.
Connection.
You think it's a connection?
Oftentimes it's not pressed in enough or something.
It's the Never mind. It's those little.
Has anybody had a chance to look at the clickable map? Like, have you surfed through it? What did you think?
I thought it was great. I thought it was very cool. I wasn't able to spend enough time on it at that point, so I won't go back. It's a great new tool.
And so she, when you do go through on the map, I mean, you can hover over each of these triangles and see very specific data about each hospital. And my main reason for just referencing this is just so we know that, this data is out there. So we could, if we were considering a more summary style, we could say, refer to the map for facility-specific information and then kind of decide what we want to focus on the aggregate kind of information.
Does that seem like a reasonable approach?
Like direct them to the map?
Yeah, where the facility-specific information would be on the map, and then the written report would just be kind of an executive summary.
I think so. I think that's a good approach. You don't want a report that's going to be...
Yeah, no one's going to read it.
So. Mm-hmm. So the only difference is... So in the report, we actually sort of list hospitals by SIR. So you could, on one page, see everybody in their SIR, and then whereas on the map, you kind of have to like hover and click, which I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's good. You're getting specific information, and it doesn't lend itself to like sort of this like.
Yeah, but
if you go back a page,
oh,
at the bottom, does rank them all.
Yeah, you can capture an area and then compare them against each other, and it gives you a bar chart.
If you scroll in, it'll just rank the few that you have.
Yeah, if you make it a smaller area, it's fewer hospitals. Because most people, when they're looking at hospitals, and they live in Ashland, they're not going to look at a Portland hospital.
Yeah.
So.
And if you click on an individual hospital, you'll see you can actually look at long data over time for that hospital. So this is just for 1 year, but individual hospital data can be found for multiple years on the map.
I think we need to have some method for the public to compare hospitals because that's clearly in the list.
Yeah, exactly. But is this sufficient, I guess? That's the question. The clickable map.
I think you need to have
a summary page.
A written instead of just the map?
Right. I think you need to have two methods of portraying it because, that would be my recommendation. Something that's a page like things have been summarized and then that more details for the main main outcomes are like class C county, maybe not every single permutation but maybe the main
so in the executive numbers. Report you have a couple of these
like,
kind of the most
the appendix like yeah something. The appendix you'd cover the big five or whatever and just have a page dedicated to each with the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think
and then this accord, because again, you just have to take into account people's different facility. I mean, like in resources and looking at this and maneuvering this, mm-hmm. or something that can be on one page and shared.
Is there a way? Because I have not looked at this in a while. I'm sorry, but from a hospital perspective, is there a way that we have the hospital stratified by bed size so that small hospitals can look at the range of, and not the SIR, but the number of infections per 10,000 patient days for a bed size 100 up to 100. And then,
stratified.
Yeah, stratified by bed size and type.
I think it'd be interesting. Yeah, it seems like we could potentially implement that in the map.
Something we definitely could.
That'd be great. I'd love to compare my hospital
to ones that are similar.
Yeah, I mean, and I think like Jen mentioned, the CDC is like so hesitant to kind of do these kinds of aggregate rates because they should be different in different places. But I think as long as it's like we're looking at small hospitals and that already controls for bed size, and then within them maybe we have a few strata that, where we convince ourselves that we're not actually like.
Yeah, then you could, you know, tertiary care centers can be their own.
And there are some already CMS categories, I think less than 50 beds, 50, 150.
Yes.
So there's some, you know, in the literature, there's some defined cutoffs that we could use.
Oh, that's really helpful. That's the kind of stuff we're looking for, you know, we can sort of start.
That would be helpful for hospitals, for those setting.
Okay.
And then this is also useful for consumers, so a consumer could type in OHSU, and then it would pop, I'm not familiar with this, but would it pop up like CLABSI rate, CAUTI rate?
Do you have a screenshot?
It
does though.
Well, so
and how easy is that
across here? I mean, you could. There's also in Hospital Compare, you can pull that information up like right away, and it'll give you the rundown, show you graphs, everything for OHS.
I'm just thinking about your typical consumer patient. I mean, like my mother's probably not going to sit down and jump into Hospital Compare, but she may be, you know, she may be very interested in that.
Yeah. So yeah, if you click on, if you choose a hospital,
okay.
There's a smaller box that pops up, and it goes through the different types, CAUTIs, CLABSIs, and I think there's a three, you know, depending on how long it's been reportable, there's a 3-year bar graph.
And if you zoom in on the section, you'll also see the hospital names and such in case someone did. So.
And this is, and maybe you could just say quickly how you got to this map, because it's live right now, right?
It is live.
So you, I think just Oregon HAI maps might be the best way to Google this. I think it would come up on that.
Oregon HAI map.
That's what Magdalena said.
Did you do any testing with the map went live with, like, you know, Joe Public, small focus group or anything?
We did testing. I don't know if we did, like, a formal kind of focus group kind of situation. And I think we did the testing in terms of Joe Public was more people on staff that would ask their family members, that kind of thing. So it was more informal. We didn't do something in a formal fashion. So
we have the association. We're looking at refreshing our quality website and making it way more simplistic because what we assume and use every day, I mean, we're not the typical users by any means, right? So it's surprising what we've learned about basic Joe Public person, what they understand about navigating something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to step out, you know, after you've been doing this kind of work for a long time. So I think it's very important. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this map is like very specific to HAIs, and Hospital Compare has, HAIs are embedded in a number of different quality, like falls and patient satisfaction surveys. So I think I kind of, for Joe Public, I feel like, you know, Hospital Compare is probably better. However, I think this provides a lot more, maybe this is better for our, you know, our population of providers really looking to kind of drill down. And so, I mean, I think, you know, we could make this, spend a lot of, you know, resources and time making it more consumer friendly, but I'm wondering if, like, we should kind of just, you know, leave that to Hospital Compare and try to kind of figure out what would help our providers in understanding their rates over time. And, like, I like your idea of looking at, like, facilities or peer facilities, things that they may have a little bit of a harder time pulling out of Hospital Compare.
I think it just depends on who your primary audience is.
Yeah, and I think we've discussions going back, like you said, I think we feel like Hospital Compare sort of got Joe Public covered because it's got a lot of that nursing satisfaction things, yes. I think that you care about when you're a patient, you go in, and that we can try to focus on providing this or publishing our data that we collect from NHS to send back to you guys who have given the data in a way that's useful. And sort of make that our niche.
It's also my perception that Hospital Compare is there's a lag in that. So are they presenting like 2011, 2012 data? I think I could be wrong about that. I'm not as updated. I mean, you have 2013, 14 data.
It's not really that much of a lag. I think it's now like September 12 through October 13, or October 12 through 13. They're kind of on the fiscal year.
Yeah, they're on the fiscal year, and I think it's through October 2013.
That's the other thing, sometimes our numbers don't quite match up with their quotes. But I think it's a question about our audience. Like, who should the audience be, you know, for the map, but also this annual report? Like, is this, like Bethany was saying something about, like, we need to get this information out to our partners in a way that's kind of where there's some, like, main messages and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what both of you are saying on that on some level. But I did want to kind of reiterate what I think Paul was saying before, that the original mandate was focused on the consumer, and I think if we completely go away from that, that could potentially be a problem. I don't know if you have that same thought.
Right. We need to check that box.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that box is checked.
Yeah.
Do people think that there's the data could be presented as sort of in a Joe Public executive summary that might be helpful for them to capture the idea?
Well, the idea was comparing hospitals. That was the whole thing.
I mean, you can imagine maybe a page where you list all of the hospitals, you see their rate, the stairs, whatever, and then there's sort of like a page on the other side that's, you know, why is this important? What does it mean? What can patients do? Kind of like the CDC vital signs.
Yeah,
that's sort of
like how to use this.
Yeah. Think about that.
I mean, I think what you have checks the box.
Yeah, exactly.
That bar graph, you know, with the hospital system, that's very easy to read.
Just do one of those. Okay.
Are there additional additional formats that you'd like the data presented? I don't know, for giving back to your stakeholders or your administrators or anything like that, or no?
The fewer words, the better.
Okay. Yeah.
CERT to me is good for a high-level view, but to really get in there, you need the rates.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that it's good to be able to get them, and it'd be nice to have them aggregated.
Okay.
So you click on everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And just sort of related to all of these comments about formats, I mean, this is kind of, we currently look at all of Oregon's data from year to year. So kind of before you see the facility-specific lists in this report, we do a little summary. So there's sort of the Oregon Hospital, like these are colo surgeries, and you can kind of see where the SIR was from year to year. And we don't do a lot of statistical comparison, but I was, this year I'd like to introduce an element of statistical comparison. We can see where we were this year compared to last year, which we can do with SIRs. And I wanted to show you this, so it's a little bit busy, but this is actually, the CDC's annual report, which is supposed to be published in January, so this is like an embargoed copy or whatever. So, basically, this is kind of how they've tried to simplify this like huge mass of data for our entire state. And so they've done some interesting things. The yellow arrows are supposed to be green, I should say, and that black one is supposed to be red. But basically, this provides kind of in one page a snapshot of where we are as a state. We have significantly lower CLABSIs than the national baseline, significantly higher CAUTIs. Significantly lower MRSA bacteremia. This is like from the little bit of data that was actually in our system. We'll have a lot more data this year. And so we're looking pretty good as a state. I wanted to point out in the top right-hand corner for SSIs, abdominal hysterectomy, that's a white arrow. So again, this is kind of the CDC's way of conveying directionality. So that this means our state SIR is 1.12. They like using percentages, because I think that's with some testing they did with the public. Like, people like to think, oh, this is 12% better than the national average. But they give it sort of a clear arrow, so it's not statistically significant. So it's sort of another idea. I don't know, do you guys like this kind of summary? I mean, do you think it's good?
You like it for what?
Yeah, that's a good
type
question.
Of report.
But yeah. for who? The
Joe Public?
I don't know.
It's good for hospital personnel.
Yeah, but I'm not sure about Joe Public, but I think hospital personnel, I agree.
Yeah. It's very dry.
And ours would be a lot busier because we have 6 SSIs and we have a lot of stuff.
It's more than 144 characters, so people are not
going to read it. See, I don't know. I agree. I think that I would love to type in my hospital that I'm getting ready to go and have a hip replacement in, and all of these things pop up, nurse staffing, all of these things would pop up that are reportable, so that I would know what kind of quality I'm getting at the hospital that I'm going to. And I think the public is, they may not be completely interested in it now, but I think they're moving towards that.
We're going there, yeah. But I still think if you can illustrate it in a, so that you don't have to sit there and read, because people have such short attention spans, even, I think, unless you're really researching a very serious thing. You know, if you're going in for an abdominal hysterectomy, I mean, the average, if you took 100 people, maybe 4 of them would actually do serious research on that. And a few more would probably do, like, to see some graphs. And the rest of them would just say, okay, God, I hope I come out okay.
Yeah, you're usually limited by where your doctor goes and your insurance covers.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, it's sort of like I do think we need to, yeah, check the box about Joe Public, but then also, you know, figure out what would be useful for facilities. And this is something CDC did with, like, their level of analysis was state. I mean, this is kind of, we could come up with something like this for a hospital, right? So each hospital you have, how do you compare to, you know, the national SIR? How did you do, you know, what is the difference between 12 and 13 in the data, things like that. So this is format.
I'm just thinking that when you think about the way people shop for stuff, I don't think they pull up, oh, I'm going to pull up this hospital and read this massive information. Then I'm going to put up this other hospital and read this massive information. I think they want to see stuff like this. They want to see, okay, I want to compare these three hospitals that are within a 100-mile radius, and if I'm going to be serious about where I want to go, and they want to see some graphics. Now, the nice thing about doing it this way, having a very simple front end, top end, is you can always put a little linky-do hyperlink, and people, if you want more detail, click on this, and then you can bring up that nice person with all the details. So I think that way you're getting at more people, you're getting the message to more people.
Think about an Angie's List for hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, and that people go in there, or TripAdvisor, where people go in, and I mean, it's kind of getting off subject, but I think that the public is getting more and more, and we should be educating the public more and more that they should be interested in asking questions.
And I think that's the way to do it. You're absolutely right. And I think that's the way to do it. The way to do it is to pull them in, but you have to present. What we're learning as a health insurance company on the marketing side, now that we're getting more and more into consumer-driven kind of care, is that, you know, people want their information in different ways, and so you can't just you have to present it in different ways, and you have to present it probably from going from simple and clear to diving down to maybe a second and a third layer, and that way you're capturing a lot of people. Some people are just happy to stay at this top level. You know, they're going to Macy's, they want to compare the handbags, and they say, oh, that one looks good, I'm going to go buy it. Others want to click down and say, okay, what's it made out of, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and I'm going to compare these two. And so whether you're shopping for stuff or choosing, services or trying to compare or trying to figure out where am I going to come out the best? You know, I think that way you're giving people choice. Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, going through, we sort of have a bunch of different ways to do it here. And then there is, I do want to pull up the hospital compare, because, I mean, this, you you can put in your zip code and it will pull up, like, the hospitals around. You can't just, like, click three hospitals at random. And this is the HAIs, but it'll also pull up all kinds of different metrics where you can really look at the hospitals side by side. So that is there. Again, it's just sort of how we maybe in Oregon, our job is to kind of message, get people to this place, like provide something. What I'm hearing is like maybe get them drawn in with something and then say, but here's a great resource for you if you want to compare side by side. I mean, I think we have to publish it, but I mean, anyway, so that's available there. So I was going to ask you, this is like a horrible way to ask this question because everything really depended on the colors on this slide, but let me see if I can do this without a slide. Do you guys think that when we list all the hospitals, so we've already decided we're going to have a list of all the hospitals and their SIRs and stuff like that. Is it enough just to see the SIR and then to have some symbol to show you whether it's significant or not? Or do you want to see the confidence interval? Like, do you sort of like the one up top? Or the one below where you have a little more information, like the dotted line is one, and you can kind of see where the hospital's confidence interval is on either side. And imagine pretty colors.
Bottom. Yeah, and you could, as I say, you can always drill down. You can always, now you can do it with just a click, and then you can get more detail.
Yeah.
If you choose to do that. But I think being able to do high-level comparisons is very appealing, and if it's got nice colors, nice little triangles, or whatever you want to use, people are used to that on other sites as well. So
yeah, okay.
I actually like the bottom one. I haven't seen that. That's what they're using now. I guess it's been a while since I looked at
hospital. Except it goes green, orange, red on the right-hand side. Yeah. Yeah. Not yellow, yellow, black.
Yeah, it really makes zero sense at all. This is kind of an example of how Tennessee's report looks. And so they, you know, if you like the SIR stuff, this is, they kind of have the confidence intervals in gray for not significant, green for significant, red for significant. So that's kind of another.
This is Jamie. You know, I'm going to be a little bit of an outlier here. I do really like seeing the confidence interval there.
Okay.
For a professional user, I think that's really important.
Yeah.
To have that.
But well, wouldn't it be nice if you can present something that everybody can use? So, because with two clicks, you can get down to all the confidence intervals and details that you want. With one click, you get down to the average but more informed consumer. And at the very top, just John Doe, who just wants to get a quick look.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I think all these comments are valuable, and I think that we know we're going to have a list like this for at some layer of our publication, then I think it's actually fairly easy to like do this sort of confidence interval thing. So maybe we'll try that out with next year and see how it goes. I think we can kind of skip through this in the interest of time. I just wanted to kind of introduce you guys to this new metric and see what you think. I'll see if we can kind of we can get to what we need in time. But so this is you all know what the SIR is, the observed over the expected number of infections, and we have SIRs for all of our different rates. And to really kind of buy the SIR is useful, you need to kind of you need to understand and appreciate and really endorse kind of how NHSN calculates these predicted value. So like for CLABSI, we won't go through everything, but you know, I mean, they decide if your hospital, how many central line days, you know, we would expect you to have. It's based on kind of the size of your location, how many CLABSI, how many central line days there are, etc. And there's the same thing for CAUTI, CDI, we kind of talked about what goes into the expected number of infections. SSI is like this individual level predictive model, so we know based on kind of the individual risk factors how many SSIs we would expect. So like we said, you know, the pros are that, you know, I think people are kind of getting used to this language, greater than one, less than one, and also this sort of accounting for the non-modifiable risk factors. And then the cons is that it really doesn't convey information about burden, and as we're trying to figure out how to target hospitals for prevention, that's something we might care about. So this is, the CDC has introduced this new metric called the cumulative attributable difference. It's literally just the difference between observed and expected infections. So if you have 7 infections at your hospital, but it was predicted that you'd have 3.7, you know, you could kind of use the language like, you know, we prevented, you know, 3.3 infections that we thought we'd have. So the CAD would be 3.3, that's your cumulative attributable difference. You had 3 more than you were supposed to have. I apologize, I just messed that up. So anyway, it's just kind of an absolute value instead of this sort of like ratio of rates. And I think in some ways it's kind of easier for people to latch onto. So this is kind of why it might be important. So in Hospital 1, we're looking at CAUTI now, you have 40,000 urinary catheter days and an SIR of 1.26. You might think, oh, we're doing okay. We have an SIR of 1.3, that's not too bad. Hospital 2 has 2,000 urinary catheter days and an SIR of 4.12. So I think we should really intervene there and hit that hospital because they have a high SIR. Let's like target prevention there. But if you look at the difference in between the observed and expected infections, they're quite disparate between these two facilities and in a way you might not expect. So there actually are more quote unquote like preventable infections occurring at Hospital 1, even though it had a low SIR. And sort of the opposite for Hospital 2. They have a high SIR, but there's only sort of the difference in the observed and expected is only 5. So we can kind of use this to set goals for ourselves. If we say as a state, we want our SIR to be 0.75. We want it, you know, 25% less than it was at baseline. We can actually like decide how many infections does that mean we prevent. And so you kind of like at a national level, they sort of did this calculation, and you know, if we wanted as a nation to reach our HHS goal of like 25% reduction, you know, we would need to target, we would need to target a certain number of hospitals. And if you just did it based on SIR or based on number of urinary catheter days, you would have to, you know, if you just base it on catheter days, you have to, you know, intervene at 600 hospitals, whereas if you were to like sort of target by where the greatest burden of infection is, you'd have to intervene at fewer hospitals. So it's really kind of a way to target prevention.
Can I ask a question on that? Is that, are you using rates or number of CAUTIs?
It's number of CAUTIs, but remember the expected is generated by, is accounts for the denominator.
Problem, and I think APIC is taking a look at this, or NISHAN's taking a look at this, is in an effort to reduce CAUTI, we are reducing our catheter days. So our catheter days are going down. So our rates will be artificially going up. So.
And therefore your SIRs,
So.
No, this is definitely an issue. I know it's been sort of, there's been some definition changes and some efforts to get at this, but it's not.
So until they change it to number of CAUTIs per patient day or something that's more standard.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to be able to.
I agree. Definitely. We should be thinking about that, though, when we're looking at our data. I think that just like a brief example of C. diff, you know, if we were to try to target C. diff and say that we wanted to have, 30%, we want to meet the HHS goal, which by 2013 was like a 30% reduction in CDI, we could set that goal for ourselves and decide, how many infections that would mean we prevent. Basically, like if we met the SIR state, if our SIR was 1, we would have a certain number of infections. But we have 718, which is fewer than we would expect. I mean, we have a low SIR, but we could actually have a more aggressive goal. And if we wanted to just have an SIR of 1, we would actually, our CAD would be negative 226. We prevented 226 more than we thought we would. So we're kind of in a good position. But if our goal was to really be at this like targeted reduction, then we would expect to have 661 infections, and therefore we would have 57 of these excess infections, and we need to like really try to reduce those to meet our goal. And we could be more aggressive with 50 or 75% reductions in CDI. This is just an example. Let me just kind of like get to sort of what the data might look like if you were to rank hospitals. This is CDI rank by this cumulative attributable difference. And so like if you look at that top table, I took the names out, but we have like a large hospital who shall not be named with like very 146 observed infections, 107 would be expected. And so we have this cumulative attributable difference of 70. And then our hospital with the highest SIR at the bottom, SIR of 3.38, actually has a pretty low cumulative attributable difference. So, is this something that you think we should be using now or in the future as a group to help target hospitals to really kind of figure out where the burden of infection is? Or is it, or have I just like totally explained it so poorly that nobody knows what it means?
It is
complicated. My initial thought is that you did a great job, but it is a fairly short period of time. So I don't know if we're going to, I don't know what everyone else's thought would be, but in terms of having some, we should definitely be doing this.
Yeah, I don't think we'll reach any conclusion, but just kind of as an overall, maybe plant the seed for something we can talk about in the future, is that there's sort of this negative kind of side where we're like, let's target hospitals that are doing poorly. Kind of the flip side is we can really target the hospitals that are doing well. So hospitals that have, are seeing far fewer observed infections than would be expected. And I think like that's something that we could potentially promote, kind of those like positive deviance type thing. Like, what are they doing and how can other people do what they're doing? And so that's something.
How are you going to target?
That's a good question. I mean, there's kind of like, we could do like the name and shame thing, like right, where you just publish that these are the worst performers, these are the best performers. Or we could kind of say when we're planning our prevention work with any money we get from CDC or wherever, let's go here to do our prevention collaborative because we have this information. So I don't know, maybe this is more of like an internal decision-making tool, but something we could.
Well, if I was in the hospital in the lower tier, I would be very interested in getting some support, maybe hooking up with our hospital association to look at what our best practices mm-hmm. that are in the works in the higher performing mm-hmm. hospitals and adapt them.
Yeah, I agree with Mary that you know there are some really clear evidence-based practice guidelines for the management of CAUTI, for example. And you know, a lot of the Portland hospitals may know a lot about that, and I'm sure Diane and that association could help as well. But you know, my question sitting here the first time is, does this group just have the responsibility of reporting this content, or is there also this connection to try to help those hospitals that might be struggling even more so about some really very simple evidence-based practice guidelines? Is that within your
I'd like it to go in that direction of what you're saying there.
I think we asked that about a year and a half ago, right?
Yeah.
Whether what's the charge of this with this group, which is it just reporting, which is according to
that's
statute,
what the
that's what it is.
Statute is.
But you know, should it go any further? Can you do it in such a way that you at least provide tools with it, you know, because I don't think there's bandwidth or funding for people going out there and doing interventions or helping set up interventions. But you know, could it come through the patient safety commission? Could there be some more of a connection between this and the patient safety commission in terms of saying, hey, we've identified this such and such, and I know the patient safety commission is also working on infection control and washing a variety of different things, but you know, is it more logically connected? That would be.
There's a lot of partner organizations that meet on a regular basis to align efforts, so we don't compete and we don't
duplicate
efforts. And so, you know, what I see this group just in my head is you've got the data and some analysis of the data, and what is really valuable is recommendations for what should be addressed. And then it's up to, you know, where let's find some dollars here or organizations that are willing to maybe already starting this work or to take it on.
Well, I think we should, in the interest of time, wrap up because we're over time. But,
thank you.
Thank you for all of this feedback. And I hope next time we have more to give you kind of in terms of report format and you can react more to the stuff we send out ahead of time. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
we're adjourned.
Find telephone line.
Yeah, how many of you have? Just kidding.